Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and this week we will be exploring eBird with Monica Fletcher. She's a local master or mistress bird watcher. She's a bird lady. And we'll discover a new way to do birding. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. So this week's mystery sound is rather different than usual. You just heard three different, and yeah, I'll tell you, they were bird species. So see if you can identify the birds making the calls, and then figure out what all three calls have in common in terms of what they are communicating. And you know what? Let's play that sound again. So welcome, Monica. It's fun to have you back. eBird, I know you're giving a series of classes this winter.
That's right.
They sound like fun. They're what, field trips and walk and talks, and it's through Audubon, right?
It's through the Audubon, and you can look it up on their website, admiraltyaudubon.org. And yeah, it's going to be fun. It's coffee and talk first to sort of like get all the technical stuff in hand. And then we go out and actually look at birds and put them in our little smartphones.
So I will admit that I've looked at the eBird app and the website. I know much about it, but there's a quote on the eBird website that boasts that the phone app, or it's probably a website as well, will transform your bird sightings into science and conservation. Plan trips, find birds, track your lists, explore range maps and bird migrations. Find the best places for birding nearby and around the world, and share sightings with scientists and other bird watchers worldwide. So, absolutely. So, the question for you first is, of all the things that it apparently can do, what do you find the most useful? And what do you think the average birder would find the most useful? Well, it's sort of like, why should I learn how to do this when I'm perfectly happy using binocs and making notes?
I was introduced to it by a cousin in 2009. And I've been a lifelong bird watcher, birder, and I have had a life list. And, you know, life lists tend to be something it's a little tiny square box next to the bird name at the back of the book. And I tended to always just check off that I'd seen a bird. And that was about it. You know, then I didn't care whether I saw a robin again or a junco again. And, you know, the numbers were less important to me because I didn't want to keep records. I've not been a lifelong record keeper. I've sort of been a life lister. And so in 2009, this cousin introduced me to eBird, and all of a sudden I had this tool by which I could actually record what I was seeing and count the numbers instead of just checking off boxes. And it's actually made me a much more interested birder.
So it sounds to me like, unlike just keeping a bird list, you're keeping the list, but you're also learning more about the birds and when they frequent our area and how many. And do you even note what kind of habitat?
Well, you can. There's all sorts of places to put information in, but it's based on maps. So you go into eBird and you locate yourself. And there's numerous ways to do that. You can do it by picking a spot on a map. You can do it by asking for local hotspots, one of which might be where you're standing. You can just put it in by GPS coordinates, and these all come up. You're out in the field, you start an eBird list, and you begin to locate yourself. That's the first given. But you're right, and it's been really fun because I've been living up here in Port Townsend since 2009. I mean, I came in 2005. And it's a wonderful way to get to know my new home because I can track those things that are, you know, sort of follow the year in terms of in the winter, we have migrants at Kaitai, you know, migrant ducks, wintering ducks. And in the spring, we start noticing territorial behaviors. And so song becomes an important identification factor. And I can know how many birds, bird pairs are in my yard in the spring. And then the babies are born and everything becomes quiet and secretive. So then it becomes a search for, is this animal still around?
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden in the summer, people are concerned there aren't any birds anymore. Well, it's just because they've shut up. But with being able to put numbers and place and time, you have this permanent record for your yard. You don't even have to have a smartphone to do eBird. There's a fully approachable website that you can sign up for, and then you just submit your lists of what you've seen on those.
By the website.
So okay. You could be a person in your house at your feeder and begin to see these patterns of what's here in July and June. And you can, you know, exercise your competitiveness against yourself or others. And it's a lot of fun. And so it's a really usable interface. It's a really accessible look to it. It's much better than your own handwriting. Like when you're looking back on your records, it'll alphabetize things for you. It will set things up by family names. You can see how many sparrows you've seen in Jefferson County, for instance. It's just like the best friend for a full birding experience.
It can be an app on your iPhone, or you can actually operate it on your laptop or computer through a website. Can a sort of non-techie kind of person learn how to use eBird easily? Should I be intimidated by this? That's the question.
I don't think so. I think people are intimidated, and that's sort of what the classes that are coming up are about. It's not difficult at all, but there are shortcuts. People get very frustrated because when you're out in the field with the eBird, it will list this unbelievable long list of things that you might possibly see. Rarities, hybrids, all sorts of crazy stuff. If you just go to this blind without knowing a few of the shortcuts, or, you know, actually you can explore eBird and they tell you about shortcuts. But there are shortcuts for how to make it really easy in the field. Things like there are abbreviations for every single bird species in the world. So red-winged blackbird is an RWBL. So it's the first letter of red, the first letter of W, and the first two letters of the second name. And if you have something that is a bufflehead, which is one name, it's B-U-F-F is the abbreviation. So instead of typing in things and then scrolling through every sparrow there is to find your white-crowned sparrow, you just type WCSP. And this is a critical first shortcut. Some people approach apps rather as if it's an extension of themselves. I think it's actually probably more difficult for people who are app savvy because they think they know how to use it and they should investigate how to use it quickly, because you want to be able to do it quickly.
If someone's interested, how do they get the app?
I only have an iPhone, so there's actually a difference between an Android eBird and an iPhone, but both are available through your app store on your phone, and it costs nothing. It's completely free. There are some things that are adjunct to the eBird that aren't free, but eBird itself, the app, is free, and the website is entirely free. And you really will be using both, because the most graphic, readable, printable way of looking at, you know, the seasons for your birds or something would be to go to the website and print it out and or look at it there in larger format.
Right.
Because it would be ridiculous to try to really read your vast numbers of checklists.
If someone just got the app and came to you and said, now what do I do? What are your first sort of tips for the beginner?
I would say start at home. Don't wait to learn how to do this when you're just going to Costa Rica, because there are complications. If you're at home, you have internet, you have the stationary element of just looking at your feeders or looking in your yard, I would just play with how some of those abbreviations. And there's also another important thing. Absolutely. People get frustrated because they'll type in Robin and they really should have typed in three because they saw three Robins. It's set up to take a numeral first, a number first, and then the species. Mm-hmm. It's a three space, and then you type in the species. And you can type Robin. It will come up. But when you get into things like sparrows, you'll get 40. Those would be my two biggest tips. Start at home and be sure to put the numeral in first. And yeah, so there's another thing where you can get rid of the super long list and just have what you've seen. And then you just need to tap those things to add numbers.
Do you worry or think about somehow changing your experience in the field and nature by being sort of tied to using a phone app in your hand rather than just, you know, you and nature and the binoculars? Is this something you think about?
It is something I think about. It is something I have experienced, and it's something I've noticed other people have. So, yes, there's an observational shift has happened for me in the field. Instead of knowing what I've seen, walking along, memorizing sort of what I've seen, I often, you know, every three or four birds will enter it. And so it's kind of like what is happening with navigational apps and things. You know, you learn, you lose the ability to direct yourself. And in this case, perhaps you lose the overall experience of, you know, noting and listing in your own head. So it's probably better for your brain to, you could still bird the old way, pen and paper, memorizing what you've seen, but you can go home and then use the website interface. And I love it because it has other features like tracking where you've been. There is an actual map that is produced with a blue line that follows everywhere you've went. It gives you exact distances based on GPS position of how far you went. And you really know that, you know, your usual dog walk is 1.35 miles, you know.
And along it, you see these things each
so
day.
So it has this benefit of that. And for if you're out all day, it's great because you can also separate out your birding. Like maybe you go to four or five different sites. You don't have to have a different sheet and a different, you know, record for everyone. It's got its pluses and its minuses. Mm.
So another sort of potential kind of concern area I think about is if it's tracking so much and housing so much data, are there privacy concerns?
That's one of the very first things I bring up in the class, which is, if you don't want people to know where you live, and that's just by nature of the fact that we bird mostly at our own homes, if you don't want people to know that you were at North Beach yesterday, there's always a one-day delay between your event and it being posted on the website. You can sign up immediately as an anonymous birder, and eBird knows who you are. You have all your lists. Everything is exactly the same, but you won't show up with your name on the website. And another concern people have is, and actually a frustration as well, another concern is people have is that they'll be contacted by people who want to see a rarity. And this is true. Let's say you had a brambling in your yard, which does come to Jefferson County, but is pretty darn rare. People would be able to kind of suss out by looking at the map features where your house is. And they could come knocking on your door
and say,
from all
me.
Over Washington to see your brambling. And if that is not your cup of tea, then you may want to consider being an anonymous birder. And that will prevent rarities from going out.
But then also, who or what is behind eBird?
That's great. That's Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Good question. I should have totally said that from the very beginning.
Okay, so that kind of relieves some of my privacy concerns because they're really very reputable and very much a source of bird information.
I have encountered out-of-town birders at Kaitai or, at Fort Flagler. So I'll find somebody, be introduced, anybody with a big scope, I talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll know that person. And I'll know when that person has been birding around the area and, what they're up to. I mean, I kind of like that. I'm interested in what people are seeing and who they are. So for me, I like it.
So I've heard eBird described as, essentially cloud sourcing. And it's then possible to see it as an example of democratizing science. Individual citizens can be treated as scientists. Public can access and use their own data or data generated by others. So I want to know if you agree with that characterization, and then if you have any examples about how eBird really can contribute to the sort of field of knowledge about birds and science.
I don't know about democratizing science, but I do know that one of Cornell's mottos for eBird is every bird counts. And it's kind of like counts as in the verb counts.
Yeah.
But it's every bird does count.
In the global perspective. Yeah.
And it's a huge crowdsourced data set, but it has real validity because it will track things. Like locally, we've had an almost 90% drop in the presence of evening grosbeak over the last 12 years. And that's a bird that flocks and was really visible for a long time. But the Pacific Northwest has seen an incredible decrease. And a lot of that is not just based on Christmas bird count numbers, although in part it is because those go back so far. But it's based on the fact that people aren't reporting evening grosbeak. And these are real numbers. These are real numbers from year to year. Another thing that happens with this, and the eBird website is wonderful for investigating some. They've produced graphic depictions of migration, like a shorebird, like the red knot, that goes all the way to the, South America in its migration, and where it stops on the way up at beaches, thanks to all of these birders in South America, and then birders in Central America, and then birders in the East Coast, by the way, which is the biggest group of all birders on the East Coast. And one, they're able to see beaches they didn't know were critical for numbers of, say, the red knot, which is a vulnerable population right now, if not threatened. And they're able to see shifts in time that they migrate. And these may reflect climate change. Every single bird counts because that becomes a data point on watching the difference between the 2010 numbers and the 2020 numbers, both in number and timing and location. And it becomes a tool for conservation of critical areas. So every single time we go out, we're contributing to that.
That's a really amazing thought, because you would hear so often scientists say, we just can't get enough field observations. We don't really know what's going on here. But this is a way to start learning, isn't it?
One of the most fascinating things I've read about eBird recently is in Southern California, in the Mojave, there is great pressure for solar farm development, huge, huge, acreage gobbling arrays of solar panels. It's the big excitement down there. And so ecologists know about wetlands and important sort of like oases in these areas and habitat that concentrates birds and are important as they pass through. And there's a lot of birds that pass through the Mojave in migration.
Hmm.
And scientists can't just live out there and answer all those questions. But they've started a program called AVA caching, and you've heard of geocaching.
Yeah.
This is AVA caching. And what they do is they put out to local Audubon groups, these are the areas we really want you to bird. And people take it upon themselves to transport themselves for free, camp out there, really look at those areas that no one has really looked at. And they can get their information finer and finer, you know, spot specific. And I think, you know, up here we could be doing AVA caching for possible murrelet habitat. Mm-hmm. It's hard to ground truth this if you're a scientist.
Right, right.
And so with the direction, and in this case in Southern California, eBird has worked with academics on doing that.
Wow. Let's remind folks, tell us a bit about the upcoming two dates that you're doing your class.
Okay, well, there's going to be another class February 22nd, and we're going to meet at Sunrise Coffee at the Boat Haven. And if we're too numerous, it's going to be limited to about 10 to 11, 12 people, just because we don't want to overrun the coffee shop. But it would be nice to have coffee and sit at the tables and go over a few points first. And so that first one is at Sunrise Coffee on February 22nd at 8:30 in the morning. And the other class is March 14th. We're going to walk around Point Hudson, but we're going to start at Velocity Coffee. Mm-hmm. So you can look on the Admiralty Audubon website and find those locales. I think there's a map for those. They do need to register.
So go to the Admiralty Audubon website.
Yeah, you can register, and that has my email on it, and that's how we're handling
okay.
it. So,
well, thank you so much, Monica. This is fun. You've actually sort of made me even more interested in learning about how to use that tool. So we're to the time where we need to hear that mystery sound again. Well, the first sounds were those, they're called seep sounds of the song sparrow, not their normal song, but a call. And that's high and it's clear. And they're used as contact calls. And they're used in families and flocks to sort of keep the birds together and know that all is well. The second sounds were the loud sort of chacking sounds. They're used by the red-winged blackbirds, and they're used to stay in touch with their flock members. And the last set of sounds were the chit-chit, I guess, calls used by the ruby-crowned kinglets, and they're used both in flight and when perched, and you've got the theme, they are contact calls. So contact or companion calls, very different than the bird song, and I've become just walking around my house more and more aware of that sort of just little chatter of, you know, the juncos do it, lots of birds do it, just to kind of check in with each other. And I want to close the mystery sound with a reminder from John Young, and he's the author of a marvelous book called What the Robin Knows. And he says, there's nothing random about birds' awareness and behavior, including vocalizations, because they have too much at stake. Life and death. Random behavior is a waste of energy, and any species that consistently squanders energy is ruthlessly eliminated from the game of life. And I would certainly recommend What the Robin Knows by John Young to anybody interested in bird communication. So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrich. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. You can email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12:05 p.m. on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM on Thursdays at 5:05 and Saturdays at 12:30. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. And thanks for listening. The ending music today is John Denver's guitar suite, Late Winter, Early Spring. It's from his Rocky Mountain.